Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
And good afternoon, everybody. Happy Party Friday. Julie Hayden here with you. Chuck Bonneville coming down. Chuck is busy orchestrating the takeover of the Colorado Republican Party. He's just wrapping up a few details on that, and he'll be right with us. Hey, a lot going on the show today. We have economics professor Dr. Dave Bieri. He's been on the show a lot. You guys love him. He's going to talk about the economy and the pandemic and the difference between Europe and the United States and all kinds of things. Patrick Neville on some of the evil doings the Dems are doing at the state capitol, essentially the Colorado version of Obamacare being talked about right now. Also, while the Democrats hoot and holler about needing more gun control, they're debating a bill at the legislature to essentially let more gun criminals go free, put them back on the streets. And then Ron McLaughlin, he is the guy who organized the Denver Law Enforcement Appreciation Day that turned into the riot last summer where the Antifa people attacked everybody. I even got punched. So he's going to be on to talk about an event coming up on Sunday, though. Chuck and I are going to be speaking there down in Douglas County. Here's Chuck. I told him you're orchestrating the takeover of the Colorado Republican Party. Truth Straight Up, the show brought to you as always by AmericasCitizenPress.com and Denver Center Genetics and Dr. Julie McCallan. Here, we'll get you centered there. But let's go ahead and jump in. David, if you want to go ahead and unmute yourself, Virginia Tech economics professor Dr. Dave Bieri. Good afternoon, sir. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Julie, Chuck. I hope you're well.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
We wanted to talk to you about the economy and the pandemic, basically. And who knows where we're going to go with this. But we've got, on the one hand, first of all, I don't even think it is a pandemic, but that's a whole different show. More jobless claims are up or down. In some places, the economy seems to be reopening. We were in Atlanta last weekend, and things seemed totally open, bustling there. Downtown Denver.
So they moved it to Denver. Everything's dead.
Yeah, the Major League Baseball thing, where Denver was dead. Europe is, Prince Harry goes back for the funeral of his grandfather. He's going to have to quarantine for 5 days.
So just five?
Well, unless if he tests negative, then he can.
So that's right. So we're scheduled to go to a wedding in Edinburgh.
We have to quarantine for 2 days.
Yeah, well, not so nice. You have to stay in a quarantine hotel for 10 days and exorbitant rates.
Free per person per day. Yeah.
Per day, including a 10-year-old. So it's not so nice. And we want to talk to you about Europe's approach. I mean, it seems we have Sweden, who never locked down and seemed to be pretty wide open. You've got Boris Johnson's Britain, which seems incredibly locked down. Its own citizens can't leave the country except for specific reasons. And I'm amazed the British are so willing to kowtown to a pretty oppressive coronavirus regime.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. It's really rather extraordinary. I mean, one of the puzzling things is, what is the European approach? Because Europe is, of course, in policy realm, an amalgam of a federal superstate and its member entities. And so there are a number of things that are going on. Of course, the police powers are still with the member states, and they've been using a variety of approaches, as you rightly point out. And in terms of which ones are the successful ones, it's really, really difficult to tell. I mean, overall, Europe is now staring down the barrel of a third wave. Now, in America, we're saying that maybe there is a fourth wave coming.
There's a 100th wave coming.
Yeah, they're never going to.
Yes, people have been, epidemiologists have been telling us, this thing is not going to the extent that it is a thing, it's not going to go away. This is the nature. It's the same thing as saying, I don't want to trivialize it because clearly there are some terrifying statistics, but it's like saying hay fever will go away. It won't. The seasonal flu is not going to go away in the case of hay fever, just in case I'm upsetting scientifically inclined listeners. I understand that it's not a virus causing hay fever, but the important thing really is to see that a lot of this is man-made, and of course how things spread has to do with policy reactions and so forth. I mean, to me, a primary concern is if I look at the relatively conservative and strict policies that the Germans have implemented, they don't seem to be working that well. The distribution of the vaccines.
I hate you using the word conservative in relation to Angela Merkel and the German regime. Let's call her crypto-fascist.
that is, by the way, in many of my transatlantic conversations, this is precisely part of the problem of the conversation, that we have different signifiers for how we look at things. In all, I certainly would subscribe to the notion that things aren't looking as well as they should in Europe, given all of the claims of superiority in so many ways, as far as policies are concerned, that the Europeans were so gladly hurling at towards this side of the Atlantic under a different presidential regime. Now, they're changing that tune somewhat, simply because I think they're embarrassed and they don't want to point to some of the structural issues that Europe as a whole, the European Commission, it's fumbling. There are no other words of the...
I want to explain to folks what happened in this vaccine rollout and the EU versus Britain and the results of those various approaches.
Well, there are really... two different approaches that were being adopted on either sides of the Atlantic. In America, the government invested upfront, a bit like a good venture capitalist, a lot of risk capital towards the production and development of these vaccines, also limiting the liabilities of these corporations upfront. And so it was really, in some ways, a big supply-driven initiative. And I don't want to, in so many ways, invoke military analogies. But the free world was once already saved by essentially a large supply-based initiative that said, look, we got to get this thing done. Let's fire on all cylinders or barrels. And so the R&D and distribution approach that took hold in the United States, $13 billion given to these corporations and say, go out and get this stuff done. I'm not saying that we'll hold you back or completely indemnify you. But in Europe, the approach was, of course, a very cautious, a very different one, and one that had as its primary objective, seemingly, the consumer in mind, the coddled consumer who can't handle anything, who cannot decide for him or herself how much risk he or she wants to take. And so this has led to ultimately botched negotiations and then a lamenting over the AstraZeneca debacle, over underproduced and underdelivered vaccine promises, which is... has resulted in a curious case of that the for the listeners, they some of them might by now know that my parents live in a small country at the heart of Europe in Switzerland. They're certainly above the age threshold where they should have gotten the vaccine a long time, but it was only a week ago that they got the first shot. Simply because I think whether you look at France or Germany or even Switzerland that's outside of the European Union, a lot of these states were tripping themselves up over red tape, ultimately, where the state couldn't get things done. The American
Didn't Britain take a totally different approach?
Well, Britain has a different healthcare delivery system, too, to a large extent. It has... Britain and in some ways, Britain in that sense, once again, is closer to the American approach, if you like, of getting things done. I am very proud to announce that yesterday I did get my first shot. And for me, it's always a sort of a fantastic ethnography of sorts, in the way that here in Southwest Virginia, things were organized in the local health district together with the university and a lot of volunteers. It was a somewhat, for my continental eyes, chaotic operation, but it got things done. And so in that sense, I marvel at the great flexibility of the American system to ultimately get stuff done.
We proudly say that Julie and I have not been vaccinated.
But I think we already had it.
And waiting for that thumb to grow out of your forehead, which is supposed to happen in about a year.
I know. Well, this brings me to another approach in terms of how governments might make you do things. Now, there is a tremendous amount of, particularly for frontline workers, a tremendous amount of pressure to get this done. Europeans, of course, have the constitutional arm where the government can, in the case of the Germans, they're already preparing this, mass immunize people by government decree. No such luck in America, thankfully.
Yeah.
There are no such elements where the Constitution would actually allow for this to happen. Having said this, the way that this is going to play out in the US is through employment laws. Labor laws give employers the right, as we've seen in similar precedents, the right to demand of their employees that they get this treatment.
Well, I'm going to demand that Julie have it, but exempt myself from those requirements.
No, I get it. And it brings about something that I think is under-discussed very often, which has to do with a free society and collective choices that have costs and benefits. And how do we manage that? How do we impose collective costs, and how do we share collective benefits?
I want to remind folks too, because I see some people have just joined us on Zoom. We're talking to Dr. David Bieri, economic professor at Virginia Tech, about the pandemic and the differences in Europe and here. You know, one thing I think that was interesting in the United States, and I'm curious how they'd handle this in Europe, a lot of people are not getting it. But if so, in the military, they figure at least a third, maybe half of the people are not. Mm-hmm. A lot of frontline healthcare workers are not. In Denver, we had an interesting thing yesterday, and I had to chuckle when I saw it. They had to close down one of the mass vaccine centers because out of it was like 1,700 people who got it, like 11 or 15 of them suffered almost immediate adverse effect. Not mm-hmm. serious, but so they closed mm-hmm. it down. And then today they miraculously announced nothing to worry about. Everyone go back and get your vaccine. And I wonder how well that works. And then I saw another statistic. And again, surveys being what they are, but I think this is a Rasmussen poll that showed, which is interesting, of the people who had received the vaccine, particularly Democrats, roughly 40% of them were still worried about getting COVID. Mm-hmm. Of the Republicans who had not received the vaccine, almost none of them were worried about getting COVID. So it is a bizarre situation where you have these people who are getting it and they're still worried.
Well, yes. And you know, in some ways, this is very symbolic of the pandemic as a whole, how we react. We're sentient human beings, and this mass panic that in some ways was orchestrated, of course, by some, in order, as I don't want to, you know, some of my more left-leaning colleagues would celebrate me for saying so, but to create the state of exception is, of course, a way in which governments can strong arm its citizens without asking permission officially when they should. And so that's been one of the more delicate elements to the extent that the pandemic has been played out on our backs.
Right. I think you're right. I think where the pressure is going to come is there's not going to, I don't think, be a federal vaccine passport.
No. But no, I think never, thankfully.
Yes,
well,
but I think
I imagine if we do go to Edinburgh, we'll probably not get admitted without a vaccine. At least that's
I think you'll see it from companies with. But you know, again, I think it's a delicate act they have because you look at this. You know, again, the news, it was front page news here. You know, 11 adverse effects, right? And then and you have all these people who are not worried about it, and it's kind of a balancing thing.
Oh, what, completely.
Yeah. What about in terms of the economies and how this is, on the one hand, we have, you know, we see at the newspaper, it seems like people are suddenly calling again about advertising, which is great. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have some clients who have closed their doors forever. On the one hand, you have jobless claims up and down and up and down. And then you've got the president's bazillion dollar bailout. I mean,
bazillion bailout of a bazillion bailouts.
Right.
I mean, what's your sort of, maybe if you could go broad and then more specific, but just overall.
Well, my broadest response to this is that unfortunately in this day and age, multiple things can be true at once. And so I think overall, most people agree by now that the US economy did not suffer as much in aggregate as the naysayers wanted us to believe. We can totally understand why that might have been politically motivated. That might have been part of a campaign to discredit the former administration. And of course, could be viewed as a campaign to get certain things done that in normal times, nobody would agree to having these massive infrastructure projects.
They don't have infrastructure.
They're sold as infrastructure projects. We still have some hopes that people will have paid attention to the history books and the great impact of the productivity of infrastructure in general. But in that sense, it's good news and bad news. It's good news. The good news, I think, is overall is that the US economy has shown what it is known for in terms of its textbook ability to adjust, to flexibly adjust. But of course, not without a certain suffering in some areas. Now, here is the even more complicated element. And of course, then I can already hear people say, well, you know, the well-fed college professor and so forth. He can pontificate because he's on a fixed salary, but I assure you viewers, it's not as astronomical as people usually believe. But it's this. Who says that some of this forced adjustment through the crisis wasn't going to bear some long-term fruit in terms of, in the same way that sometimes an organism benefits from an unexpected year of less plenty. And so I think some of the adjustments in areas of industries that have taken a hit might not all be terrible news. It doesn't, of course, take away the enormous suffering for local businesses, family businesses and so forth, who are still in many ways waiting for any form of state or federal help. Although there have been some programs, but these programs were clearly abused, as always, by large corporations or organized criminals. And so that's a delicate element.
As an economics professor, why don't you explain? Because I think people are wondering, well, why don't we just keep on printing the money? I mean, Joe Biden, you know, they had $1 trillion one under Trump, and then Biden came in, another few trillion, now he wants the $3 trillion one. We seem never to be worse for wear as we're building up astronomical debt that can never be repaid. Why can't we just keep on printing
more? And give
more?
Us some of it.
Yeah, and even give middle-class people something why not? Yeah.
Well, that's right. Because, I mean, history has shown that if you overburden the economy by debt, in the future, somehow you will have to pay it back. And so it's simply a generational transfer. The other element is, of course, is that we don't necessarily know how the printing of money will translate. And a lot of people are worried about inflationary effects and what this might do. Again, personally, I'm less worried about the overreach or the inflationary dangers. But I am worried about giving government so much control that it can essentially dictate what it wants to do. You see, that to me is the larger danger. Whilst a lot of people say, well, it's over indebtedness and the debt ceiling and this, that, and the other. No, I'm more worried about a large government, a behemoth-like government, that then essentially displaces activity in the economy simply because it can now afford it. And so the best way, because he can't slay the beast, you need to starve it to a large extent. And there are all sorts of other ways, by the way, that the government could stimulate the economy. We know, and we teach our students in their intro to macro courses, that, of course, government consumption or government expenditure is only one of the areas that help, that make up GDP. Equally, household consumer expenditures, private investments, And so the government has it within its toolkit that it doesn't need to be, it does not need to be the big spender. And this is where I think in some ways the narratives are currently a little historically misaligned in terms of suggesting that, well, because consumers aren't spending and private companies aren't spending. One of the largest reasons why corporations are not spending is because they rather sit on cheap cash, courtesy of the Federal Reserve and its unconventional monetary policy, than actually take on much needed risk. Because, you know, last time I checked, is we live in a capitalist system whereby individual actors, particularly investors, are rewarded for taking on risk. But this they must. If they sit around lazily, because the government has distorted the system to the extent that you can no longer read what is risky and what is not, then to essentially then say, well, the private sector isn't doing its job, so therefore the government should be doing it, that is problematic, right, to say the least.
Well, wait. What is happening to the British economy, which they really have locked down? Here we have kind of sporadic lockdowns in Europe.
Which would be the best way to open up the economy, by the way, and stimulate it, is to let businesses go back to business.
And there seems to be, I have a sister and a brother-in-law who you know, don't seem to be worried about the fact their whole country's locked down. And how is that economy doing under that kind of regime?
Well, the problem with the British situation is, of course, that you mix in the Brexit things, the consequences of Brexit. And so to currently disentangle the two is absolutely impossible. And the political pundits, depending on which side of the debate they're actually sitting, will point to one or the other as the cause. Mm. For now, I think there are certainly a number of sectors, particularly small and medium enterprises, that are suffering, that have been suffering in the run-up to Brexit. So there are no news there in some ways. Excuse me. But again, overall, Britain is doing surprisingly well, given all the doomsday's scenarios. Now, at the same time, you know, this is Great Britain, an island or a collection of islands, and insular mentality is in some ways one of its strongest exports. And so I think there is currently quite a bit of that, that the numbers, because they themselves, the large trends are lagging indicators. So we don't necessarily have a full picture of what's currently going on.
How does China play into all of this? I mean, you talk about a behemoth government the United States is trying to create that can do whatever it wants. How does China factor?
Where to begin? Yeah. Where to begin, Julie? And one could even say, you know, to the Politburo, as they're listening in to our very conversation right now, thanks for tuning into this interesting program. We will speak our minds. I think that China is a riddle wrapped in an enigma, as Churchill once said, of Russia.
A mystery.
A mystery. That's it. And so I think the issue is that we know it's an authoritarian government. If we had any questions about it, all we needed to look at is the WHO's report into the origins of the Wuhan virus, where surprisingly nothing was found.
Yeah.
Now, to me,
I think it was the US military's fault, is what they're saying now.
That's right. And so, as always, but part of the issue there is of course, that the China's got a large domestic market. It doesn't really need to worry too much about external relations. On top of which, strangely, people have no longer mystified by the fact that we are believing the Chinese that they've completely quashed the thing. I don't know whether I've mentioned this to you, but I've had Chinese students who wanted to leave, who actually went home over Christmas and haven't been able to be returned because they were they disappeared in quarantine. And I mean, it just goes to show that there is a certain amount of forcefulness with authoritarian governments that, again, in the quashing of a public health crisis, they will do as much of exercising as much of that authority as they can.
Was I hearing, did I remember this correctly, that out of all the world economies, like China is actually doing better now since the pandemic than before? I mean, United States is recovering. Is that true, or did I just, was that a
mis- Yes, but then there are two things. One, can you trust government statistics? Because you know how well one can lie with a statistic. And right. And I hate to say it, that the Chinese have manipulated their statistics in their favor for as long as we can remember. But even independent estimates would say that China is still rapidly growing. It's urbanizing rapidly. And so in that sense, it's not a fair comparison. Because in some ways, you have to argue that whatever economic losses we've been incurring or had to pay for to live in a free society, when a global pandemic hits. And so I think the US economy is doing well. Europe is doing surprisingly well. If you look at the forecasts of about an annualized 4% GDP growth at the end of the year, it's not all that bad. And that might make you wonder a little bit in terms of...
what's going on? Well, I was going to say, Doctor, we're going to have to let you go now because we have somebody coming up at 3:30. But I want to tell people we're going to start next month. We're going to have you on at least once a month to talk about just a wide variety of economic issues, because
that's
there's
wonderful.
So much there. Oh, I know. Mm-hmm. And you're great. And so for people listening, you could feel free to email us or text me or somehow if there's something you want to know too, you'll take requests, right?
Absolutely. I would very much enjoy that. And then I could even prepare a little something that it's tailor-made to your listeners in terms of their particular concerns and interests, because there is so much to talk about.
And then finally, you also are speaking on this very topic, the economy and the pandemic, right, at an event coming up?
I am indeed. We're cross-interrogating representatives of the European Commission's economic delegation at an event next week. And so I'll be happy to report back what we're hearing from the policy spin doctors out of Brussels, why they're doing so much better than we're doing on this side of the Atlantic.
All right, David, thanks. Graham, we'll look for you as a regular contributor on the show. It'll be great.
Wonderful, wonderful. I wish you both and your listeners a relaxing weekend, and I look forward to catching up with you soon.
All right.
Thank you. All the best.
All right, Dr. David Beery there from Virginia Tech. Hey, Thomas, if you want to go ahead and we can call Patrick now, but Patrick, just so you know, only has a few minutes. He has a class. We kind of bumped him down. And they're talking about the vaccines are going to be in short supply over some issues in production. I thought it was just funny that they're like, everyone go out there and get the vaccine. And like, oh, we had all these adverse reactions. And they're like, oh, nothing to see here. They were totally, the article, they didn't explain what caused the adverse reactions. They just told us we didn't need to worry about them. Yeah. And it's like, well, wait a minute.
You can trust the government. They wouldn't lie to you. The Hancock administration or your federal government. They're
right.
For you.
That's right. No, they would never.
They're there for you.
They would never. That's why those companies needed all that, release from liability, Chuck.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to see here. So don't, those adverse
don't
reactions,
worry about it.
You're screwed.
Don't bear worry words.
Yeah. All right, we've got Representative
Patrick Neville. And we consider him the last of the wild Mohicans, a conservative in the state government. Patrick, it's great to have you on. You missed being at the organizational meeting for the Republican Party, although it may be attended by Zoom or some other method. But one of the more heartening ones was when Scott Gessler, instead of just having one person second him, had an entire film in which Chris Hulbert endorsed him, and that was followed by Hugh McCain, and it was followed by Gardner, and it was followed by Sonny Liston, and it was amazing. It just went down the list. I'm not sure it was effective in the sense that...
he lost.
He lost, but moreover, people, we were sitting in the crowd going, oh, man, I hate that Liston guy. Oh, he's for Gary. No, I'm going to the other guy. So it was a whole cavalcade of your colleagues that were roundly rejected from it. And I know they're not on your side of the
plexiglass
ceiling. What did you think of the?
Yeah, I was laughing when I saw that too. Okay.
You can make your list. It's kind of like all the people.
Yeah, you noticed there was, I was definitely absent on there on purpose.
Yeah, you were not there. You were not there. Well, why don't I ask you, before we talk about the color Republican politics, it's just important because it's so hard to keep track of all the awful things the Democrats are doing. Two things I wanted to talk to you about. I think today, didn't they have the first hearing on taking away all of our medical rights and choices, that bill. And then also, while they're jumping up and down about gun control, aren't they also trying to say how we need to release all kinds of criminals who have gun violations so they can shoot, so we can't have guns, and it's a crime for me to have a gun and not report it. But if the criminal has a gun, that's no big deal. That's okay for them.
Or he, her.
Yeah, right. Actually, yeah, the public option is being heard in committee right now. So Democrats said, well, how's the way we can do this without the least amount of people noticing? Let's have it on a Friday afternoon.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you.
They're having this committee going on right now. I'm actually still at the Capitol, but folks like Dave Williams are still in that committee. And yeah, her and this bill, basically the insurance commissioner, can run this private charity. So that is no longer subject to Tabor, they're saying, even though the insurance commissioner is going to run it. And this private charity can force every hospital and, you know, down to your massage therapist to participate in this private insurance program that's run by this private charity that's run by the insurance commissioner, who then can set prices on what they have to accept into this, this what they're calling the public option, which they're trying to bill it as just this, oh, it's just another insurance product that's on the market, but it'll be run by our state insurance commissioner by the force of government and force every single provider out there to accept it, which means all the good providers are just going to flee the state and we won't have any healthcare providers left.
So you mean even a massage therapist, even your massage therapist is going to be under your acupuncturist, stuff like that?
Yeah, as the bill's written, yeah, they don't leave any stone unturned. It's just,
excellent.
It's almost like they sat there and developed some sort of task force of like, who else can we mess with? Who else can we mess with?
Nail salon people, because, well, yeah, Dr. Donna is telling us H-Bill, House Bill 21-1232, she says guaranteed to fail, Amendment 69 under another name. Is it going to go through, do you think? I mean, it seems to me there isn't a way to stop it, is there? Well, unless the health...
Yeah, no, I think it is. And I think, you know, they're being even extra stubborn now. They've delayed it like 3 weeks now from being heard, supposedly trying to cut some deal. And then they said, well, we're not going to cut a deal, so they're going to move it forward anyway. And the governor's strong-arming every Democrat down here on this bill so hard that I don't see any Democrats peeling off. I mean, it was good to hear that Senate Bill 182 was killed before it ever made its way to the House, but I don't know if this one's going to have that same effect. He's strong-arming every single person. And I think the real thing to watch here is, I haven't seen it yet. I'm hoping it won't happen, and actually I don't think it will happen, but what they are so good and effective at doing is going after that one Republican and saying, oh, man, well, you know what? We're going to make sure. Let's put some money in here for the hospital in your district, and you'll look like a hero. Sign on to this bill, and then they... That's all they need is one, and then they can turn around and go, hey, it's a bipartisan bill, yay.
It's a Priola bill, Priola bill.
Oh. Well, and it's disturbing because it is one of those things, because it's complicated, so therefore the media doesn't cover it very well,
Everything is language, as we've come to really understand, you know, public option.
We should
call that the government mandate. And then people, oh, I'm not sure I like a public option. Yeah, a government mandate? Oh, not so much. It is. It's
well, they wrote the language.
Well, it's socialized medicine. I mean, what it is, but it's socialized medicine in 3 years instead of immediately, because that's essentially what it's going to be. Is no one's going to be. So you don't. They're saying, well, you don't have to have this insurance. But what's going to happen is every other private insurance company is going to go out of business because they don't get to set their own prices. They actually have to go there and negotiate them with the providers. And then you may have a plan that's federal plan, like I'm on TRICARE, that might still be around, and you know, you could choose to opt to stay on TRICARE. But the problem is, good luck finding a provider that's actually going to be able to accept you without a huge long wait list, because all the providers aren't going to be able to get paid and actually be profitable under this plan. So they're going to leave, and I don't blame them. I mean, especially the best and brightest, they're not going to be able to afford their malpractice insurance, their student loans they took out, and everything, like especially your specialty docs and your, I mean, you talk about some of these guys, their malpractice insurance is so incredibly high, they're going to be operating in a net loss under this plan.
Right. Well, and I think here's the thing to keep in mind too, Patrick, is the reason they're doing this is they want the socialized medicine. That's their end goal.
Sure.
And so they're going to deliberate. So it's not like, my guess would be, it's not going to be like, oh, we care about your doctors. No, their end goal is to get rid of that and have socialized medicine in Colorado. So they're going to deliberately, I would imagine, right, set the prices intentionally, set the prices so that if you're a private doctor, a private company, you can't compete. And you'll just say, like the oil and gas.
That's exactly what will happen. And then in 3 years, when there's no doctors left and doctors are saying, we're all going to leave because we can't pay our malpractice insurance, they'll come in forward and say, we've got a plan for that. Let's make you a government employee. And then you don't have to have malpractice insurance because you've got the umbrella of government indemnification. And so then they've got exactly what they wanted the whole time.
And what could go wrong with all of this? Are there any other states that have this?
Nothing even close to this. I mean, this is basically Jared Polis and the crazy libs telling California, you think you've got this? Hold my beer. I mean, we're going to one up you. This is really radical.
I love it.
We're going to be so screwed.
Well, luckily the Denver Post and the other media are right on top.
Yeah, they don't know.
Well, let me ask you about the Exalted organization that I belong to, and you are a former member of the executive committee of the Republican Party. I got elected from the 7th CD, so I said, well, gosh, I got to make sure, you know, what are my duties and where do I need to be responsible and all that. And I said, oh, okay, the budget, I have to approve the budget. That's great. So I called LX up and said, hey, can I see last year's budget and the audit of it? Not last year, because you're on a 2-year cycle. And he said, well, let me talk to somebody.
It's secret.
And then I said to our new chair, Christy Burton Brown, right on this show, I said, hey, can I have a copy of the budget and any audit thereof?
It's secret.
And she said, I'll have to ask. I was going to ask, who do you have? The janitor?
Well, she said they can't because they're worried. They're worried, Patrick, that the Democrats might find out what's in it. I don't think the Democrats are particularly worried right now.
I used to do SEC work, and I also represented the government in getting money back from crooked SNLs. And I went, you know, when I'd go in there and ask for the books, they'd come, oh, they're not available. Oh, they got lost. The dog ate them. Oh, they're all gone. Why do I think I'm joining the mafia or something included with the oath of Amarte to it? And they said, well, we'll have our first meeting and we'll prove the budget then. And kind of going, well, wait a minute. We need time to study what you're recommending.
No.
And no, you don't need that.
Or compare it to last year's.
Right now, what they'll do is they'll show you a PowerPoint presentation of here's how much we raised, and here's on the board, here's the folks on the board, and hey, isn't that great? We're so transparent.
Yeah.
Well, then in the past. Then Chuck found out that even
and then they stopped even doing that. They stopped even doing that because then we saw that they have like all sorts of lobbyists down here that like even at the Capitol that work on Democrat and Republican bills all the time. They have like those folks on the board, and you're like, what? These guys are. I mean, they're working against me half the time down here. You've got them on the Republican Party IEC board. It's
It is fascinating. That this is how the Republican Party is run. And we just had the announcement
today. Not shocking,
though, really. That we have a new executive director and a new finance director. Exactly the same. And the new executive director was the old
communications
director. They're all in the age of 12, but they should be, you know, we got a new GOP going and our new executive director has a wealth of experience, they said, a wealth of experience, which is great. When you're 24, you can get a wealth of experience, and particularly when one of your main jobs was being spokesman for Liz Cheney. That was before. Do you know any of these
people, Patrick?
It seems like the executive board is treated like a mafia corporation where you don't need to know anything. And you just, let's get some beverages and get you out of here.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what it was for me when I was on that committee. And I mean, what they were really good at was every time they failed, it was then, well, it's Neville's fault. You know,
it's just like
and I'm sitting there going, wait, the state house is the only one that maintained their level of seats. You know, oh man, we lost everything. But hey, it's just Patrick Neville's fault. You guys never even coordinated, didn't help us on a single house election. And here we are, we actually maintained our, and amazing, we had folks like Greg Brophy who, you know, work with that board and make money off of that board and the IEC, and they were working against the supporting Democrats.
Well, how did friend Greg work with the executive board? What did he do?
He was a lobbyist, so he got your money.
Well, you know, they contracts to different vendors, and Greg works with those vendors and, you know, plays both sides and all that good stuff. And so he was out there and even advising folks like the NRA that, well, you can't endorse Stephanie Luck. She'll never win, doesn't have a chance. And so, I guess we have Representative Luck, by the way, some people don't know, she did win.
Well, I know Greg and our other former minority leader, Mark Hillman, raised money for the Democrat. But they said that's before the Republican got nominated. So it's, oh, okay, that's good enough. As long as you did it before their nomination, you can raise as much money as you can get them, possibly.
Right. Yeah, it's just crazy. Yeah, we got to learn to play with the Democrats. And I'm like, what are you talking about? How is this helpful whatsoever?
Let me, Patrick, I know you got to get going. And just final open-ended question for you. Anything else you're keeping an eye on that you want folks to know about?
Oh, well, next week's budget week, so that'll be fun. We've just got, look, there's tons of garbage bills. I think one that pops in my head that came up this week was the Office of the New American. And the Office of the New American will serve all sorts of people, including those who aren't Americans. You know, we're talking illegal immigrants. We're talking everything that they're calling it, the Office of the New American. And then, but it's okay because it's going to be funded by gifts and grants donations the first year. And so, you know, it's like every other, and then we even asked them, too, the funny part was like, so what services do you provide? It was almost something out of the movie Office Spaces. Well, we're not going to provide any services, but we'll connect them to other departments that will. So we know darn well, you know, next year they're going to come back and say, we saved so many lives. We did such great things.
We got so many people registered.
Now we need to fund it. So that we can connect more people to more government funding. Aren't even Americans, but we'll call them New Americans.
There we go.
You just have ridiculous bills like this going through, and it's pretty depressing being down here. And that's like, I mean, that's even one of the lower level ones. I mean, there's like huge ones like the public option that we're facing now. So it's,
thank goodness marijuana.
Yep, elections have consequences.
Yeah, luckily we can tote up and feel better.
No, they do have consequences. Patrick, hey, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Hang in there. Try to stay optimistic a little bit.
Get an A on that exam.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Representative Patrick Neville there fighting the good fight. Yeah, this public option bill, we'll be keeping an eye on that. It's
government mandate bill, Julie.
Yeah, the government mandate bill. It's going to be bad. It's going to be horrible. And Dr. Donna's got it right. Hey, and Thomas, if you want to go ahead and call Ron McLaughlin too, we can get him on the line. One thing though, there was a bit of good news. They did at least cure. Remember, we were telling you earlier they're going to have that bill that you had to be registered, and it was the bill essentially to create an office to get rid of misinformation. They were going to monitor all media organizations.
Oh,
podcast.
The media thing, yeah.
Yeah, the media advisory board is still there with Cal Clark. Although, let me finish two thoughts. Okay. So that one that, where we were all going to have to register and they were going to punish you and stuff like that for misinformation, that died. The media advisory one, though, that's going straight through.
Your but kids, Kyle Clark would be in trouble. Kyle Clark,
but here's
manhandled
what's fun.
By Joe Biden.
What's fun about that is, if you guys want to check out a story in Westward. So I don't know if people saw a former Channel 9 reporter who happens to be a Latina was let go and has been complaining about how racist they are over at Channel 9. Now today, Westward's doing a good job on this. So is Stephen Tubbs, I will say, by the way.
Okay,
they filed a big complaint with the Securities and Exchange Commission against TEGNA, basically complaining about all the racism at Channel 9. I haven't seen Kyle Clark's comments on this, but
I don't think they'll be commenting, Julie. No, they can't comment on internal affairs of the organization, as we all know.
Kind of like when they shot and killed the Patriot.
Can't comment on murder. Of people at rallies.
Right, or racism.
Or much anything. But Kyle will be with you tonight at 5 o'clock.
There was kind of a funny story. Apparently Dave Lugie, who I actually know and I always thought was a nice guy, who was on the board now. He's a Nine news director on the board of Tegna, which owns Nine, was apparently at some board meeting where they were going to be interviewing other board members. And one of the candidates was African-American. Only Dave mistook him for the valet and gave him his car parking ticket. So, no, hey, it's like,
it happened. That was, I get keys handed to me all the time.
It couldn't happen to a
nicer. And then I take the car.
Yeah.
We got Ron McLaughlin on, our guy who's organizing a Back the Blue rally. The last one we went to, we got beat up. And you got smacked around. So how's this one going to work out?
Hey, Ron, thank you for your time. What, you there, Ron?
Chuck, Julie, how are you guys doing?
We're good. So, Todd, we got this rally coming up. We're going to give it another shot in Douglas County coming up this Sunday. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, it's we're going to be at the Douglas County Fairgrounds. It'll be from 3 to 6. Lo Becker, who did not get a chance to play back in July, is going to be doing the music. We've got, quite a lineup, actually. We've got people coming from... the K-9s will be there. We're going to have the American Heroes Action, Dave Prophet. He'll be there. You're going to be there. Randy Corcoran's going to be the MC. Sennenberger's going to come in and play, bring his harmonica to play with
the
Blow.
But I have one.
It should be a lot of fun.
Could I make one request? TV be set up, because I'm sure you guys didn't happen to notice when the Masters tournament is played. So small TV, so we can just kind of pop in and back out and see if Jordan Spieth's going to win the Masters or not. Because it's the same time.
But, well, we can make that arrangement for you. They're still going to have that in Georgia, aren't they?
Yes, that's going on. So folks want to come. So it's 3 to 6 this Sunday at the Douglas County Fairgrounds. Admission, do people need tickets, or how should they find out more?
No, I never charge. It's all free.
Okay.
Come.
Okay.
Of course, we'll have food from O'Malley's up at Palmer Lake. A lady named Denise, what is her name? Goss. We'll bring the food truck for that. We'll have different vendors from, we have Tommy, he's going to have her candles there. Melissa's going to be with Angry Grenade's going to have her stuff going on there. It should be a lot of fun, guys. The Douglas County guns will be there. Let people know about how to protect yourself.
Yeah. Well, we'll need that. Who from BLM and Antifa is coming?
Yeah, the Antifa
time,
people. Right? The guy,
they've got reservations.
The guy
they got
with
a booth.
The big horns.
Well, I don't think the train runs that far out from Denver to get all the way to Castle Rock.
Okay.
Chances are they're not going to be there. I can't imagine those guys coming into Douglas County. It just doesn't make sense.
All right. Well, it sounds like a great event. We will be there. And encourage everybody to go there. Douglas County Fairgrounds.
It should be a lot of fun.
You know, all the people who tried to show up at the Capitol and we ended up getting attacked, I think this is a great chance to get back there and once again show our support and say, hey, look, we're not backing down. We're not going away. And you can't keep us silent.
And we won't have the Denver police there to protect us.
Right, we don't have to worry about the Denver police.
Well, we may actually have
that event's going to be redone this year on the 18th of July.
We'll be there. I'll be there.
All right, Ron. Well, listen, thank you for your time. Good luck, and we will see you on Sunday.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys. Have fun. See you Sunday.
All right. Thank you there. Douglas County Fairgrounds, 3 to 6. Come on out. Say hi. I mean, we'll be there. We'll bring Rev. I think it should be a lot of fun. Wanted to briefly talk about, there's so much going on, the whole gun control thing. That could take a whole show. But in case folks haven't paid attention, so Joe Biden today, this is interesting. Joe Biden, who said he would not ever consider, and it wasn't our business, actually, even what he thought about packing the Supreme Court, right?
Oh, yeah.
Is now launched a bipartisan commission to pack the Supreme Court.
Yeah, right.
Interesting. Some of the people, I didn't realize this, but one of the biggest organizations that's been, now I forget its name, but it's been pushing for packing the Supreme Court in term limits is funded by another organization. And guess who worked and was a big person involved in that organization? Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki.
Yeah,
so she
loved her.
She worked for the court packing organization.
Yeah,
and there's another person in the two. Because keep in mind, Joe Biden, I think, has no idea what's going on, right?
Well,
and so Joe Biden.
He has a general vague view that something's going on.
Joe Biden, who told us it was none of our business what his thoughts were on that, has now launched a bipartisan commission. That's all go to on one of those gambling apps and take place bets on whether we think they're going to push back in the Supreme Court and term limits.
Well, they're going to study it because it takes a lot of study.
For like a week?
Yeah. Well, no, it's 180 days. You've got to look through a lot of stuff and then decide, yes, you know, we shouldn't have 20 new Democrats. We just should have enough to control the Supreme Court of 10, and then we'll get rid of all your liberties. And it'll be excellent. It's a great tradition, and I think it's good.
Well,
somebody asked, did Chuck or Patrick say that Mark Milliken raised money for the Democrats? No, it's Mark Hillman, used to be a minority leader for Republicans, raised money. Mark Hillman, not Mark Milliken.
And what these guys are, guys, and he and Greg Brophy, what they were legislators and became lobbyists. And since the Republican Party doesn't really have any money, they're like, okay, well, we'll take money and lobby for Democrats once again, and we'll do a whole show on this. That's why we need to get rid of the open primary in Colorado. The Democrats...
Liberate the primary.
Yeah, liberate the primary. The Democrats are playing and pouring money into the Republican primaries to put in what I consider to be fake Republicans to make sure that's in districts that they can't win as a Democrat. So they just call themselves a Republican and the Democrats finance the heck out of them. And then they win and they beat the true Republicans. So was there anything else on there that we wanted?
I don't know. I can't see.
Oh, yeah. We bothered to read our glasses. Okay. Yeah. Back to my question, Chuck. This is for Mark. Who the hell is running the country? It's not Joe. And Charlotte. Okay, Jan, one-legged duck. I'll circle back to you on that, Saki. Well, again, you know, the Democrats are, this is a strategy that's been long in there, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, they want to pack the court. I mean, why not, right? That way they can control it there. Just in case us pesky voters actually happen to elect a Republican president again. That will be illegal too. That'll be a new Supreme Court ruling. Yeah. What about, though, I have mixed feelings about term limits on the Supreme Court. What do you think on that?
As a general idea, I think it's a good one. It's sort of, and it's been true throughout the history of the Supreme Court, where people literally have been put in insane asylums and they still sat on the Supreme Court. They just temporarily put away for a while. It's ridiculous that you ought to have people in their 90s on deathbeds making decisions for everyone. So I think term limits for once. But the trouble is the Democrats will cheat. And so whatever law we get, and of course the Republicans will fold. So it will be such that the term limits will be such that they only expire on Democratic administrations or something.
So idea,
appointing people for life is just a real bad idea. And as much as they lionize Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she was a shell of a human being.
Right.
And lots of them depend totally on their law clerks. Now, I was a law clerk, so you know, great for relying just on those guys, but they weren't really appointed.
Well, and I think I was reading something the other day, too, that said it's not just the Supreme Court. I mean, we need to be aware of this, too. It's not just the Supreme Court. It's the lower courts, too, the lower federal courts, the district courts, and the appellate courts. Hey, I see Mark popped in. Hey, Mark, we got about 3 minutes here.
Okay, Chuck, it's a Supreme Court question. I watched Roe v. Wade the other night.
Oh, good.
And it is, I think, a fantastic movie. I would like you to watch it, and I'd like to hear what you say since
where is it available?
It's about four places. Just type Roe v. Wade, and it'll tell you. I did it on of the video streams. Fandango had it. It's not cheap, but I highly recommend it.
Okay,
and after I watched it, I thought Justice Roberts was one of the worst justices I'd seen in my life. But when I watch this, if it's really true, I'm appalled at the Supreme Court. And it's a lot of it makes sense to me now. So I'll hold judgment, but I wish you'd watch it and tell me if you think a lot of it's true.
All right, Mark, we got
pretty powerful. I know you got to go. Bye.
Thank you. I'll watch it.
Thank you to Dave Bieri, to Patrick Neville, to Ron McLaughlin, to everybody on Zoom. We love having you guys on Zoom. ChuckandJulie.com is where you can get everything. Thank you to the great folks at BBS Radio. And that is it for this Party Friday. Tom Cancredo on Monday.
Bye-bye, everybody. Have a great weekend. I'm off to the...
Scott Club.